You're listening to Metro on KGNU, Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. I'm your host, Tim Hernandez, and today I'm going to be speaking with author Kelly Little Hernandez about her latest book, Bad Mexicans, Race, Empire, and Revolution in the Borderlands. Welcome, and thanks for being here with me today, chica. And my first question for you, Kelly, is really, can you start off by giving listeners an overview about what your book is about? Give us a rundown.
Sure. So this book tells the story of a group of Mexican radicals who fled Mexico in the early 20th century after spending years trying to organize against the dictator in Mexico. That dictator's name was Porfirio Diaz. And they came to the United States trying to rebuild their social movement so that they could oust Porfirio Diaz from power. And once they got to the United States in 1904, they were able to relaunch their underground rebel newspaper, Renacion. They were able to establish a political party, a Partido Liberal Mexicano, the PLM, and they were able to establish an army. And it's really an army of the dispossessed, of miners, of cotton pickers, of migrant workers, who raid Mexico from Texas four times between 1906 and 1908. And those raids really shake the stability of the Diaz regime. Now, that really threatens Diaz, but it also threatens the United States, because by the early 20th century, U.S. investors had a really major stake in Diaz's Mexico. They had gone down and bought up land and built major industries, railroads, mining, and more. And when the dissidents in the borderlands, the PLM, began to raid Mexico and threaten Porfirio Diaz's reign, they also threatened the security of U.S. investments in Mexico. So the Mexican dictator began to work with the United States government to put together a cross-border counterinsurgency campaign to stop these rebels from organizing a revolution. And so this book tells the story of these dissidents known as Magonistas and how they rebuilt their social movement here in the United States, and most important, how they outran and they outsmarted both the United States and the Mexican government to be able to incite the outbreak of the 1910 Mexican Revolution from the United States.
Before anything else, I love the title of your book, like deeply, deeply love, right? The bad Mexicans, and specifically within that word bad, because I think for a lot of people in this country who own their non-white racial experience, respectability politics cut deep into us, you feel me? And there's something that so many of us live with constantly, whether it be undocumented immigrants forced to live up to the impossibility of the good immigrant narrative, right? Or my field, right? I'm a public school teacher where teachers of color struggle to navigate the politics of entrenched racism in schools that are way too eager to get us out. I'm curious, why was using the word bad, right, the first word on the front cover, why bad Mexicans? Why was that important here for you?
Sure. So that title comes directly out of the archives. So the dictator in Mexico labeled the rebels malos mexicanos, or bad Mexicans, because they were challenging his regime. They were trying to take him down. They were not being subservient. And a subservient Mexican was a good Mexican in this dictatorship. And a rebellious Mexican was a so-called bad Mexican. Now, this is also true on the U.S. side of the border. This early 20th century period is the very beginning of mass immigration from Mexico to the United States. And U.S. employers, U.S. power brokers expected Mexican labor migrants to be compliant, servile, and cheap and racialized temporary workers. And when you had Mexicans organizing, establishing unions, demanding higher wages, insisting upon healthy working conditions and healthy housing, they became disparaged by U.S. employers and power brokers, also as bad Mexicans. So this story is about rebels, right? About people who refuse to comply with the status quo and had their own dreams of plenty for the impoverished, of land for the dispossessed, of power for the marginalized. And so this group of people who are being disparaged as bad Mexicans, I want to invert our notion of that. In fact, these are the rebellious folks, and they are the people for us to look up to.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think governmental repression and narrative and history are so important. And I think, you know, taking that directly from archives, slapping it on the cover of a book to talk about the feats of rebels is a really beautiful way to transform language. You feel me? Your book also describes little known, but you know, like I was saying, suppressed political moments in lands, you know, currently called the Southwestern United States, but were just a few generations ago indigenous and Mexican lands. And the suppressed history in your book is of the political upheaval and literal revolution in Mexico in the 1900s. I'm curious, man, just from my personal, how much digging did you have to do to uncover these bad histories that were intentionally kept shut away?
You know, that's a great question. So we have to, you know, make it known that the Maguanistas, who were more or less led by this person named Ricardo Flores Sagón, they are legends in Mexico. There are towns named after Ricardo Flores Sagón and other leaders of this movement. There are gyms and schools and whatnot. They're taught in the curriculum. This year, 2022, the Mexican government declared to be the year of Ricardo Flores Magón. He died 100 years ago in Leavenworth Prison here in the United States, and they're honoring his life and his memory and his impact on Mexico. The issue is not in Mexico. Scholars have been studying the Maguanistas for generations. And I would say here in the United States, Mexican-American historians have been also studying and publishing about the Maguanistas. But that story has yet to penetrate into what is understood as the canon of U.S. history. And I would argue that that's because Mexican-American history and Latinx histories in general have not penetrated the canon of U.S. history. And so what I'm hoping is that this incredibly cinematic, riveting tale of revolution in the borderlands, it's got assassins and spies and armed rebellions and love affairs and betrayal, all of this, right? It's got all the makings of a phenomenal movie, that we can take this story and smuggle into the canon key issues in U.S. history and Mexican-American history as well. So, for example, when you start to read about the Maguanistas or learn about the Maguanistas, you learn about the origins of U.S. imperialism. It's in Diaz's Mexico in the late 19th century that U.S. investors first begin to make foreign investments and to seek to dominate an economy without taking over the land. So it's in Mexico where U.S. imperialism is born, and the Maguanistas are battling against that birth of imperialism. They're also battling against white supremacy across borders, that U.S. imperialism in Mexico is a racialized form of imperialism. And when Mexicans are being dispossessed in Mexico and come to the United States, they run headfirst into a web of white supremacy in the United States. They run into segregation in schools, segregation in housing, a high level of racial violence. More than 500 Mexicanos are lynched in the United States between the 1870s and the 1920s. And the Maguanistas are rebelling against all of this.
Yeah.
So we were able to take this story and bring to the broader reading public key histories of empire, of race, and of rebellion in the United States.
Absolutely. And I think it's, you know, I appreciate you talking about the prevalence of that narrative in history in a canon like Mexican history. And I think how deeply, right, as a public school teacher, about how much labor goes into suppressing history sometimes. And I want to go specifically, because you mentioned it as well, about the lynchings of Mexican people, right? History is like the lynching of Antonio Rodriguez, right? His lynching in Texas, you write, is an influential and catalyzing event for the beginning of the political upheaval in Mexico that sets the foundation for the Mexican Revolution. And I feel like stories like the lynching of Antonio Rodriguez are shut away because martyrs play a really pivotal role in movements. I'm curious about your thoughts. What do you think is the impact or the influence of a martyr like Antonio Rodriguez in a movement like the Mexican Revolution of 1910?
So you're referencing an incident, a lynching, that opens this book. In early November of 1910, a young man, Mexican national named Antonio Rodriguez, was accused of murdering a white woman. It was also rumored that he was a member of the Maguanistas, and he was burned at the stake in Rock Springs, Texas. And his murder in Texas was responded to throughout Mexico, where riots erupted in protest against Anglo-American violence against Mexican lives, whether it be in the United States or in Mexico. And so that is a catalyzing event to the outbreak of the 1910 revolution, which occurs later that month in November of 1910. I certainly think that events like this and martyrs like this are catalyzing events. One of the things I try to do with this book is complicate the figure of a martyr a little bit. Ricardo Flores Magón, in some ways, is often understood as a martyr, that he lived his life in and for rebellion, and is often seen as a sacrosanct hero, right, of the precursor of the revolution. But I want to dig a little bit deeper into organizing politics and personalities and try to really scope out for folks what their social movement looked like. And Ricardo Flores Magón, as brave and as brilliant and as bold as he was, right, he was the one who would use his words like weapons against the dictator in Mexico when nobody else would. He would call the dictator a tyrant, a despot, that he had made Mexicans so-called servants of foreigners. Nobody else said these things against the dictator without accepting death. But Ricardo was also someone that if people didn't follow him, he would turn against them and use those words as weapons against some of his closest allies and friends. So complicating the figure of the martyr, I think, is also important so that we can see and understand ourselves in history as being complicated, textured, complex human beings who can change the world even if we're imperfect.
Maybe even expand on it. Of why do you think it's important to complicate martyrs in the service of deconstructing and maybe even decolonizing the ways that movements work, right? Because movements are not led by one person. Movements are not performed by one person. Ricardo Flores Magón is one of the greatest writers of the 20th century, I think, right? The speech where he gives and he goes up in front of everybody and all he says is the Diaz regime is a den of thieves, right? I'm thinking about how somebody who oftentimes is capitulated as an individual who leads things, I'm curious if maybe you could break us down how your book and how the story of the Magonistas, right, and their interconnectedness and community orientedness in things like focos, in things, you know, in the U.S.-Mexico border, in towns and campesinos. I'm curious, can you speak to why it's essential to break down and complicate martyrs for the sake of a movement?
Well, let's talk in a grounded sense around the Magonista story. So Ricardo Flores Magón and his friends come to the United States, and they're quite successful in rebuilding a social movement. And the Mexican government and the United States government see him as being the figurehead of this movement. And if they can take him out, that the movement will die. So their idea is if he can be deported or extradited or killed or imprisoned, then the movement will die. And in 1907, their spies and their detectives, alongside their Los Angeles Police Department, raid a shanty at the edge of Los Angeles. It's a hideout where Ricardo Flores Magón had been living on the run. And they arrest him and two of his colleagues, and they drag him through downtown, and they throw him into solitary confinement, and they basically think that they can now wash their hands of the revolution. Ricardo Flores Magón is in solitary. The revolution is dead. They throw parties, and they think it's over. But the fact is that they had built a social movement, and the women in particular emerge as powerful players who hold this movement together as Ricardo Flores Magón is in prison. And so I think a key piece of this book is to talk about that organizing history, that we all have roles to play. Ricardo played a particular public role writing as a writer in particular, but he wasn't everything. The women, youth, migrant workers, the people who stood up to be soldiers in the PLM army are the ones who carried the revolution forward when the figurehead was taken out. After Ricardo Flores Magón is put into jail in 1907, that is when the PLM undertakes three most significant and lethal raids from Texas into Mexico that really rattle the Diaz regime and make the world think the Diaz regime is coming to its end. And what's important to really to write about that and bring that up to the fore so that we're not telling the story of one man who took on two governments, but really about a community.
Yeah.
Diverse of men, of women, of youth, of elders, of families, of intellectuals, of artists, of workers who came together with a shared vision of radical change in Mexico. And it's only through that community that they had the power and resilience to be able to persevere against, you have to understand, the Guggenheims were after them, the Roosevelt, everyone was after them, Teddy Roosevelt was after them. Some of the most powerful people on earth were trying to shut them down. It's an extraordinary tale of community and resistance in the borderlands.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's bringing me the quote by another victim of the FBI, Chairman Fred Hampton of the Illinois State Black Panther Party, right? You can kill a revolutionary, but you cannot kill a revolution, right? A revolution. You can jail a revolutionary. You cannot jail a revolution. I think hearing the history of the Magonistas and hearing, you know, women, youth, campesinos, and these massive groups of people that really don't, they're not inheriting a movement from Magon, right? They are actively taking the driver's seat. I think is so pivotal, and I think so important to name, to address, and to remember, because, right, like, everybody's got a role in the revolution, right? Like, that's my personal philosophy. I think, like, everybody has a front line. Everybody can contribute something, and I think it means creating movements that are conducive to that. You feel me? If you're just tuning in, you are listening to Metro on KGNU. I'm your host today, Tim Hernandez, and I am speaking with author Kelly Little Hernandez about her latest book, Bad Mexicans, Race, Empire, and Revolution in the Borderlands. We're talking about resistance history, right? The Flores Magón brothers loom large in your book about resistance, and you named it for us as well, right? Magón is well known in Mexico. He's well known in Chicano communities like my own as well, in Denver. And there's comparatively little name recognition for them in the U.S. mainstream society. You feel me? But I want to hear it explicitly. What do you think was their influence on not just social movements, but state-sanctioned, politicized policing in response to social movements, right? We're talking about how they were jailed and the revolution was inherited and taken over by other people in it, and it switched so many hands. Specifically, when we're naming the people like the Guggenheims and the Rockefellers and the Roosevelts, and what do you think is the influence or the foundation that the Magón story, the Magonistas, give, or what is their influence on state-sanctioned policing to disrupt social activism in the states?
Well, I think we now know a considerable amount about the rise of what we call mass incarceration over the course of the 20th century, certainly since the end of enslavement, the period of enslavement. We rarely talk about what the impact has been of Latinx communities or how that has impacted them, at least historically speaking. And I think this story, the Magonistas, is one example of how, as the U.S. carceral state or police state is growing across the course of the 20th century, some of it key institutions such as the FBI, which is the U.S. counterinsurgency super force, right? You talked about the Black Panthers, you talked about the American Indian movement. The FBI is all in all of that, right? Trying to shut it down. The FBI took its first breath trying to suppress the outbreak of the Mexican Revolution, trying to stop the Magonistas from inciting the radical revolution in Mexico in particular. And so they helped to shift or pivot the early FBI away from just being about land issues in the American West, which Teddy Roosevelt had originally imagined it to be, and to being about suppressing workers, racialized workers, and radical communities in the borderlands and elsewhere. And so I think the Magonistas put Latinos, Mexican Americans in particular, at the heart of the story of the rise of the carceral state in the 20th century.
And thinking about how the origins of that were really like baptismally practiced upon people like the Magonistas. I'm under, you know, the very personal opinion, right? We already know why they worked so hard to stop the Magonistas. It's because half of the U.S. foreign investments in the early 1900s were in Mexico. You name that for us, right? The Magonistas are a political threat because they're an economic threat to the United States.
The notion that we are established by freedom. I mean, we are a white settler society that is predicated upon elimination of Native communities and began with the enslavement of Black folks, period.
Yeah.
End of the conversation. That is in the bones and the marrow of this nation. From that, everything else rose. And so it's not much of a surprise by the time we get to the mid-19th century, and that as this white settler state is expanding across the North American continent, that they are acquiring additional lands by invading, as you said, both indigenous communities and Mexico. And that it's not just about taking that land, it's about removing indigenous populations, excluding or subjugating black populations. And that new U.S.-Mexico border that is developed after the U.S.-Mexico War is a racial border. The United States claims as much land as possible without having to get very many Mexican people, right? That's why the border is drawn exactly where it is. It is imagined as the distinction between so-called white America and so-called Mongol Mexico. So this is part and parcel of the history of the United States, that emerging out of Native elimination, black enslavement, you have various forms of racial subordination and control at the U.S.-Mexico border. That's certainly happening with non-white communities who arrive at the border, have historically been criminalized, blocked out, and managed as migrant populations. And so that, nothing about this is shocking to me when you begin your understanding of U.S. history as it being a white settler state, and we set aside these myths of freedom being the founding philosophy of the United States. At the end of that, it comes to the conclusion that mass incarceration is really nothing more than a project of mass elimination for BIPOC communities, queer communities.
The question that I really want to ask is, I think in our movement work today, right, I think it's really, really hard with the media culture that we have, with the social culture that we have, to work through difference. I'm really curious, what do you think the legacy of the Magonistas and your book hope to capture about how we work through difference in movements?
When I began to write the book, I think I held Magon on a pedestal, like many people do, having not really dug deep into the stories of him, not just outcasting, but outing members of the movement, right?
Yeah.
And other actions. And so I came to a more, you know, flawed and human understanding of who he was. And I think I came to a place where it was his really rigid ideology, his refusal to build a broader political community with people like Estela Ramirez, Camilo Arriaga, Juana Belén Gutiérrez de Mendoza, Juan Sarabia, as you talk about, and others, that he, at the end of the day, I think fundamentally isolated himself and disempowered the movement component while retained the wholeness of his ideas. And I think in many ways it's his refusal to engage in the ground game, right, that allows him to maintain that ideological purity. Right, whereas Praxidus and others are on the ground trying to actually move the dial of power in Mexico. So my personal perspective coming out of this, I think it's even more refined, is about we need all hands on deck. The struggles that we are engaged in and the powers that we are confronting are so intense and comprehensive that I prefer a big tent approach, and that we all have something to give, we all have something to chip away at as we move toward building power for our communities.
My final question to you today is about movements as well. And it's a question that I had since I started reading this book. I'm really curious about your perspective after deeply studying the Magonistas, right? But the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo happens in 1848. And about 50 years later, the Mexican Revolution of 1910 with the Magonistas happens, right? Then 50 years after that, the Chicano movement in the United States happens. And our social conditions now are debatably more stratified than they've been in a lot of different time periods. But right now, we are 50 years removed from the Chicano movement. And so my question is, are we overdue? Is it time? Like, I don't know how to ask that question. But, like, more importantly, do you think revolution is something that, like, we can time? Right? Is it something that we can create?
Well, of course, they're always created, right? It takes intention and plans and strategies to affect radical social change. That's part of why I wrote, I mean, there's a lot of reasons I wrote this book, many, many reasons I wrote this book. One of them was that when President Trump, who's running for office, disparaged Mexican migrants as so-called bad hombres, I knew exactly how dangerous that rhetoric was and how violent that rhetoric was. But because people don't know anything about Mexican-American history, they didn't know what he was tapping into, what he was summoning, right? Which is that history of lynchings, that history of Juan Crow. When he says, let's make America great again and calling Mexicans bad hombres, he's talking about taking us back to that time. And I wanted to write a book that really exposed the violence of that rhetoric. It is also that we are in this moment, right, when many people are talking about will the Latinx community, Mexican Americans in particular, be Democrats or Republicans? And I think that's too confined a set of choices, that there is a radical legacy that the Magonistas sit at the beginning of, right, that Latinx communities are bringing to the surface, but that we have been, you know, that communities have been severed from the history of, the anchor of, the roots of, that radical organizing and set of possibilities, especially, you know, the book ends with a Plan de San Diego, which is an uprising led by Mexicanos in the borderlands, but with a radical imagination for what happens with indigenous, Black, and Asian populations come together to throw off the shackles of white supremacy. This book, in many ways, is about lifting up a radical Latinx political set of possibilities and agendas, and remembering that there's a long history that people can hold on to as they're politically engaging in this moment that's not about Democrats or Republicans. It's about challenging capitalism. It's about challenging white supremacy.
Absolutely, yes. I find those same limitations, you feel me? I was raised in a really unique political circumstance that offered opportunities for decolonizing politics, right? For Chicanismo and Chicano politics and all these things. But I hear two points that you're lifting out that are so important to name, that one, solidarity is the way, right? First and foremost over anything, right? We don't fight racism with racism, we fight it with solidarity. And two is that liberation is not about the choices that we have. Liberation is about the choices we create for ourselves. And I think that that is really the over-encapsulation of your book and the beauty of what we created for ourselves, about what our people created for ourselves in a time that rivals the social condition that we experience now, that mirrors the social condition that we have now. And so as we're coming up on the end of our time, I'm really curious, Kelly, is there anything else you'd like to add, any reflections you'd like to invite our listeners to make?
No, I mean, I think it's probably important here for me to note that I think many people presume that I'm Mexican-American. I am not. My husband is Chicano, but I am African-American. And this work is a work of solidarity. My body of scholarship is a work of solidarity. That for me, our pathways forward as communities is through this project of solidarity. And so I'm so thankful that you've heard the register of this book. I'm so thankful that you also see solidarity, our pathways forward to a better future for all of our children and our communities. And I just thank you for this conversation. It's been really wonderful to engage with you as an ethnic studies teacher. You are changing minds and possibilities, and I appreciate you taking this time today. Thank you.
No, thank you so much, Kelly. I really do appreciate it. You're still my cousin. Don't trip, man. All right.
That's still family.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, man. Now, listen, hermana, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate you. My guest today has been Kelly Lira Hernandez, author of Bad Mexicans, Race, Empire, and Revolution in the Borderlands. Kelly, thank you for joining me today on KGNU. See y'all later.